Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi-yo. Welcome to Kiwi's Birth Tales. My brother name is Ollie and I'm Die Boy. Thank you for listening from Mommy's podcast. See you later.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Kiwi Birth Tales. I am your host, Jordan. I'm a mum of two. I've got Jai, who's 3, and Ali, who is 20 months. I've got a business baby, which is your birth project, and your birth project is the online hypnobirthing course you need to create your best birth. It is also an online store to support pregnancy, birth, and postpartum. There's some incredible products in there, all recommended by me or the mums that listen to the podcast or follow along on the social media communities. If you order on the day before 1 o'clock, I try to get orders out same day, unless it's a pre-order, and there are some incredible toolkits or bundles on there that help you save some money and give you all of the necessary goodies for pregnancy, birth, and postpartum. So make sure you go and check that out. Oh, goodness me, I did manage to get another birth story episode out this week. I didn't think I was going to, but here we are. And today's a goodie. I speak with Claire, and Claire is the PCOS nutritionist. You might have heard her podcast or follow her on social media. She's a wealth of knowledge about all things PCOS, and it was really interesting to hear her experience with pregnancy and birth and postpartum, and sort of some PCOS information woven into her story as well. So I know that you're going to enjoy this episode. Claire ended up having a failed induction, for lack of a better word, and she had a previous surgery that meant that her cervix wasn't going to properly dilate. So she talks us through that and how she landed at an emergency C-section and how that all sort of played out. What she wished she knew in pregnancy about C-sections and, I guess her experience with the birth education side of things was really interesting too. So I know you're going to enjoy this episode. I'd love to hear your feedback if you want to find me at Kiwi Birth Tales on Instagram, or you can send me an email, Jordan with a Y, J-O-R-D-Y-N, at kiwibirthtales.com. I hope you love the episode. Thanks again for choosing to have me in your ears. I'm super grateful that you come back here week on week and listen to these episodes. I hope you get what you're looking for and enjoy this beautiful episode with Claire.
Hi, Claire. Thanks so much for joining me on the Kiwi Birth Tales podcast today.
My pleasure. Long time listener, first time caller here. So it's so good. Yeah. I was saying to you that I was going to do this episode myself on my podcast, and then I was thinking, oh God, how boring. Like, it'd be so much more fun to do it with you.
Yes, I'm so happy that you're here, and I'm really looking forward to our chat today. But before we jump into it, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about you and who is in your family?
Yeah, so my name is Claire, and I am a registered nutritionist. I specialize in polycystic ovarian syndrome, and so my business is called the PCOS Nutritionist, soon to also be OVI, which is our new app for people with PCOS to help them identify what's driving their PCOS and to make the most important lifestyle changes for them. So it's our way of being able to do that at a much more cost-effective way than having to go and see a nutritionist or dietitian or exercise physiologist or naturopath or anyone else that kind of helps in that, and the pathway for improving PCOS through changes. And so, yeah, we're really trying to find a way to do that in a much more cost-effective way that people can actually afford. So that's what OVI is and what we've been working on for the last 5 years or so since trying to find a better way to do this. And that all came out of my personal experience of having PCOS and just not really getting any help from my doctors or anyone really I spoke to, even if it was like a woman specific doctor or a naturopath or a dietitian. And luckily I was already a registered nutritionist, and I also have a degree in exercise science, so I could understand what I needed to do. But it wasn't really until I really understood PCOS that I really got that there are fundamental things that happen in people with PCOS, like for some people their insulin and blood sugar isn't working well, for other people their stress hormones aren't working well, or their thyroid or inflammation, and these are what really contribute to the symptoms, and these are the things that we can actually fix as well and therefore improve the symptoms. And so so that was really, for me, was a huge huge part of my journey to becoming relatively symptom free now, and also a huge part of my birth story as well, was all of the components of PCOS and how that definitely affected my my birth story, which is super interesting because I've listened to so many of these podcasts, and it's quite common to hear some of the similar things coming up, like gestational diabetes, which is not something that I had, but was something that I was aware that I was predisposed to, and low milk supply. So yeah, there's lots of things that when you understand why, it just makes so much more sense. That's me, that's what I do. And so in my family is my partner Scott and my daughter Florence, who's 14 and a half months now. So she was born March last year.
Awesome, very cool. Well, we've got lots to chat about today, and I'm very interested in your sort of journey with PCOS and pregnancy as well, because we have a lot of mums who come on the podcast and have PCOS or were diagnosed with it at some stage. So yeah, really interesting, lots of things to talk about. But let's start with the journey to pregnancy for you. So talk us through, what did that look like, and keen to know how your PCOS might have played a part in that process.
So it probably, the journey to pregnancy probably started unintentionally 10 years ago, when I first got diagnosed with PCOS. And like many people with PCOS, the first thing they'll say when you're like, yay, okay, finally I've got an answer for all these symptoms, like why I'm getting acne and why I'm gaining weight and why I haven't had a period in 3 years, and they're like, yes, the answer is go on birth control and take metformin. And you're like, cool. And also, oh yeah, that's right, you probably won't be able to conceive, so just come back and see us when you want to get like pregnant. And I was like, it's not even on my radar right now. Like, irrelevant, but also alarming. Tell me more about that. And they didn't really have an answer. They're just like, oh, PCOS, just, you know, like you probably won't be able to get pregnant, so yeah, just come back and see us. And I was like, wow, that's quite a statement. It definitely did rock me, even though that wasn't on my radar at the time. And really, you know, for me, it would have been, and for every person that I work with, it would just be so much more helpful if there was some context given around that statement. Like, yes, there can be fertility challenges with PCOS, but if you know, if they just maybe even gave a one-line statement that was like, you're not ovulating at the moment, that's why you're not getting a period for the last 3 years, but hey, if you can get that back, if you can get a regular period, regularly ovulating, then it's highly likely that you won't have any problems conceiving. So just understanding a bit about why the fertility issues, because especially when you don't know much about it, your mind immediately goes to, oh my God, like IVF is the only answer. And that was certainly the case for me. I remember getting out to the car after that and going, oh, I'm going to have to set up a new bank account to start saving for IVF. But that literally is what I thought. So fast forward a few years when I really understood about what was going on, why I was getting these symptoms, and then what I could do about it. So for me, when I was diagnosed, I was also diagnosed as like insulin resistant, which is sort of in the pre-diabetes spectrum, which was quite a surprise because I was an elite athlete at the stage. I was competing for New Zealand in athletics and then triathlon. So that was quite a shock. And also I was a registered nutritionist by this stage as well, so I was like, whoa, how did this happen? Like, I am what I thought was the healthiest person I knew at the time, and you know, like, I was training 20 plus hours a week for triathlon. I was eating like following the sports nutrition guidelines, and so that was, you know, a huge thing to be diagnosed as pre-diabetic at 25. And so really what I found out, like, as I started learning more about this, was it's really common in PCOS. About 85% of people have some insulin resistance or pre-diabetes, and this is really part of the picture of why we develop the symptoms that we do. And this is one of the things that can be really, really easily addressed through lifestyle changes. So when I understood that, and I actually like modified my diet, like yes, I was following the sports nutrition guidelines and I was training heaps, but those are the way that I was doing it is not the best thing for someone who's insulin resistant. And so I had to, even though I was eating quote unquote healthily, I had to eat differently to support my blood sugar and insulin. And same thing, I had to change the kind of exercise that I was doing. It was really causing a huge amount of problems with my stress hormones, which was also causing my body not to ovulate. And so I really had to change those like components, and also lots of other things. Like, I was sacrificing sleep for training and for work, and thinking that I was doing the right thing when that really wasn't supporting me. So fast forward to when I actually implemented those changes, my body started ovulating relatively quickly. And then, so I was back probably 5 years before we started trying to conceive, I was already ovulating really regularly for like 5+ years. And so when it came to trying to conceive, we actually conceived really easily within the first try. And I was not young. I was 36 at the time. So it just kind of shows that if we can fix all those hormonal factors of why we might not be ovulating, for most people, for 80% of people with PCOS, like that's all we need to do. Is really get what I call the fertile ingredients right, and then things like there's no reason why fertility should be an issue. So that was was definitely my experience, and so it was a really, like, for what could have been a really hard journey, it was actually a really easy journey in the end.
Yeah, amazing. And how were you feeling when you found out that you were pregnant? Did you miss a period? Were you experiencing other symptoms? Talk us through finding out that you were pregnant.
Yeah, so I've tracked my basal body temperature for years. This is one way that I used for contraceptive purposes. And then also, like, that's how I knew that I was ovulating and knew that my cycles were really regular. And so I could actually see that my basal body temperature stayed high. So this is one of the first things that we can actually see before even a pregnancy test will tell you that you're pregnant. I kind of knew that, and then it was just the pregnancy test to confirm that. But it was really interesting. I still felt quite shocked seeing it on the pregnancy test. It's kind of weird. Like, it was just this, oh my god, this is actually happening. Even though I knew that that's what it should show, it still was quite surprising to me.
I reckon that honestly, like, every person feels that way. Like, even if you know and like you just know that you're pregnant, it's still a shock to see it on the test, I reckon.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, like, even though this is my job, I work with people about this all the time, it was still such a surprise to see it for myself. And I remember showing it to Scott, and I think his first response was, holy shit. But I think that we both probably expected that it would take a little bit longer than what it did, just because of our age, but I think that's why it was like, oh gosh, this is really happening now. Very exciting, but also still
awesome. And in your first trimester, did you have many pregnancy symptoms? How were you feeling in those first 12 weeks?
I was actually quite lucky. I didn't have too much nausea, just that constant hangover kind of feeling. It was mostly kind of food aversions that I sort of couldn't eat what I would normally eat. Actually, it was actually a really good experience for me, because working with so many patients all the time who then, one of the things I work with PCOS patients is on fertility. And so many of them get pregnant and then go through first trimester, and we're having to adapt what they're eating. And so it's actually, I knew this theoretically, that you didn't have any control over this. It wasn't something that willpower could overcome to keep eating, maybe what I've been giving them. But it was actually really good to actually feel that in reality myself, because it just gave me so much more empathy for my patients to go, you know what, I get it. If your body's saying no to that food, it's a hard no. This is not something that willpower can override. This is a hard no. So we need to find something to get around that. So that was not so great at the time, but actually I was pretty lucky. I think I only vomited like twice. And so compared to so many of my patients, I got off absolutely scot-free. But yeah, apart from that, could still do everything normally, still able to work out. Actually, that was the one place I did vomit, was in the gym. It was quite alarming, under the water fountain. That was a bit,
oh no.
It was quite rough. I tried to like hide it as much as I could with like the handy towels, but still the guy on the like bench beside me was just like, yuck. Like, sorry, mate. but yeah, so it was a pretty good trimester, first trimester by all accounts.
Yeah, awesome. And did you go with a midwife for your care, or what did you choose to do there?
I went with an obstetrician. And because I did experience some early pregnancy bleeding, and not much, just a little bit. And I had had a previous LETS procedure for abnormal cervical cells. And so I knew that this could predispose me to early labor, preterm labor. In actual fact, it was completely the opposite. But it was that, and I had private health insurance that did cover an obstetrician if there were reasons. And my doctor was like, yeah, this LETS procedure, like, it is a bit dicey. I would go with an obstetrician. So that's why I ended up going with an OB.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. And what about the testing that's offered in pregnancy? Did you choose to do it all? What were your thoughts on finding out the sex of your baby? Talk us through that.
So I was quite, I didn't really care. In hindsight, I really did enjoy finding out the sex, because both Scott and I were quite sure that it was a boy, although I was just saying it was a girl because I wanted to create some diversity of tension. He was saying it's a boy, I was saying it's a girl, but I did actually feel that it was a boy. And so I feel like if I'd gone through the whole pregnancy thinking that it would have taken me quite a while to get my head around that she wasn't a boy. So in hindsight, I'm quite glad, but I wasn't necessarily super keen on finding out. I was like, oh, whatever. Scott was like adamant that we're going to find out. We went through we did get all the tests. So we got the, is it the NIP test, the 11 week test?
Oh yes, NIPT.
Yeah, NIPT. And so I think we got a call from the midwife at the obstetrician clinic. Actually, it was during lockdown, so we're out on a bike ride, as you do. And so we're out, and I remember getting a call from her, and I was like, got off my bike and was standing in the gutter. And she was like, she was on speakerphone, and she was like, do you want to find out the sex of the baby? And Scott was like, yes. And I was like, not here. We're standing in the gutter. Like, can we make it like slightly more of a solid, just an event? So so we did end up finding out that we were having a girl relatively early, 11, 12 weeks. And then definitely did opt for all the testing. And in fact, I was like quite pushy for more testing. Like, I was like, I want my ferritin measured every trimester. I want to go for the full gestational diabetes test. I don't want just the hour, but like the intermediate one. That's just because of what I do. I knew that I was going to be at risk, and I just wanted to like know and be able to make, do something with that information, as opposed to just flying blind and hoping for the best.
Yeah, fair enough. Awesome. And what about birth education? So did you do antenatal classes? What were your thoughts around, finding out more information and education about birth?
Yeah, so I did antenatal classes. I also what I found in the antenatal class was that it was really great for a lot of information, but there wasn't like probably enough information for me on like the mechanism of birth and how the baby actually comes out and what you could do to support that in terms of like the actual pushing and pelvic floor and things like that. So I also did another course through some like physios that I found who were really, it was really helpful on like the mechanics of birth and pushing and what you can do and kind of preparing for labor and stuff like that. So I think the antenatal group was It was awesome. Learned so much, but then I also did more more work on that side as well. And we'll talk about it in a minute, but probably a waste of time in my in my story. But it was good to have like done that prep and just be a little bit more aware of what I could do.
Yeah, for sure. And did you have, like, based on that information, any thoughts around what you wanted your birth to look like or a birth plan?
Yeah, I always found the term birth plan really strange because I was like, this is one thing we have absolutely no control over. So I was like, I want to prep for, like, if my body can birth vaginally, then yes, that's the way that I would want to do that, and I will go with whatever I'm feeling at the time. Maybe I love swimming, so maybe in the water would be good, but if we get to the hospital and there are no birth pools or anything like that, then I'm not going to be too worried about it, because I feel like if I'd had this in my head about exactly how it was going to go and then something didn't go right, like we got to the hospital and there were no birth pools, then I would have, you know, like it would have thrown me more than just being a bit relaxed and fluid about it. And I think that probably put me in good stead for the fact that my birth did not go like that at all, and it didn't bother me at all. So but even like in saying that, at the start, like one of the other reasons I did go with obstetrician is I felt like found that in New Zealand it's quite hard that we don't have a choice about how we birth. I feel like this is, I understand the reasons, but I feel that this is quite a, it's a big thing for a lot of people. And if you have really strong feelings that you don't want a vaginal delivery, it's really hard if that's not what you want. And I feel that our system really doesn't cater for any other opinions, or not just opinions, but people's feelings around how they would want to birth. Yeah, that was one thing I did find tricky. So I guess from the start, I probably didn't have really strong feelings that I wanted this, you know, really beautiful Mother Earth at home vaginal delivery that was non-medicated. That to me, it was like, whatever happens. And if I can birth vaginally, then I'll probably recover quite quickly and all of the benefits of that. But if I can't, then also not a big deal.
Yeah, awesome. Cool. And what about your birth preparation? Were you doing anything like antenatal expressing, or, you know, drinking the teas, eating the dates, all of that sort of stuff? What did the end of your pregnancy look like?
Yeah, end of pregnancy looked like a lot of curb walking and a lot of sideways look from the people around the neighborhood. I did a lot of perineal massage. So that was one thing that my OB was like, this is, you know, a really good thing to start doing from about 38 weeks to, and also the course that I was doing as well also said that, just in terms of like reducing risk of tearing. A lot harder than what it sounds. Like,
it is.
Perineal massage sounds like that should be a nice thing. It is. Yeah. I found it quite painful, and it is quite like tricky mechanically to get, because basically what it is you're pulling down on your perineum, which is the part between your like vulva and anus, and so you're really like getting your finger in there and pulling that down to try and like stretch that out. So mechanically, like, it's actually quite hard to get around there, and also then quite painful, like kind of pulling that down. So I was like, this needs a rebrand, this is not a massage. Although probably a good way of getting people into it. But so I did that. I was doing expressing, although didn't get anything, like not a single drop. And that was quite interesting. But apart from that, nothing else. Due to my like insulin resistance, dates were off the table because they're still going to increase your blood glucose. And I was like, actually, The research is pretty slim on their actual effect and the risk of like my blood glucose, because by the third trimester, so one thing I did do was I was wearing a continuous glucose monitor just once each trimester, just kind of see what my blood glucose was doing. And by the end of it, by the third trimester, I could see that I had, I tried different foods and see how my blood glucose responded, even though like I didn't get diagnosed with gestational diabetes, but I just knew that I was more at risk. And during pregnancy, bodies get more and more insulin resistant, so through the trimester, and that's the way that our body delivers nutrients to the baby. So I would have something, I remember having testing different foods, and one was because I was pregnant during summer, and I was like, right, I want to find a great non-alcoholic drink that I can have during summer. So I had like a Heineken Zero, and my blood glucose spiked up to like 9, which was quite high. Like the optimal that I would work with my patients is like 7, 7.5. And so I was like, whoa, this is not like going to do it for me. And so I also then tested some dates because I was like, well, I know the dates are going to be like, recommended towards the end, and same thing. So they were off the cards for me. And yeah, but apart from that, yeah, just lots of curb walking and just lots of mobility exercises. That was really the main thing that I was doing, was a lot of still a lot of pelvic floor, actually more like learning to release my pelvic floor, because when I did a pelvic floor Warrior of Fitness with Caitlin at Unity Studios. So Caitlin, who's the
Oh,
vagina
cool.
physio on Instagram, and she was like, "Well, Claire, you are just trying way too hard here with your pelvic floor exercises." She was like, "Because they have a really cool device, and so she gets you to do your pelvic floor exercise, and then she can see on the machine." And she was like, "What you're doing is you're like doing it, and then you're doing this extra like kind of crunch at the end, trying to like go extra hard." And she was like, "No, don't do that. Don't do that." So that was my problem was more like turning it off. So yeah, doing a lot of that, doing a lot of mobility, still doing a lot of strength training to try and stay pain free, which worked so well right up until I was still like lifting weights until like 2 days prior, and I just felt great. I literally felt like I was myself with a basketball up my top. That's no symptoms, no pain, no nothing. And so it was, yeah, I was really lucky.
Awesome. Cool. And okay, so we're at the end of your pregnancy, and you're feeling pretty good. Talk us through that sort of final couple of days of being pregnant. Did your labor end up starting spontaneously? What did all of that look like?
Yeah, so this is where it got really interesting. So the research at the moment shows that if you're over 35, your chance of having a vaginal delivery are better if you go into labor about 39 weeks. And so I talked to my obstetrician about this, and they were like, "Yep, totally agree. Let's if you haven't gone into labor, let's get you induced." That wasn't accepted by the hospital, and so we didn't end up doing that. But at 40 weeks, 40 like 41 weeks, they could get it through, and so I went in for an induction. And so this was also like the middle of that. So this was February 2022, so at the end of February, so that real peak, first peak of COVID, where it just
Oh,
suddenly
COVID,
exploded. And so I went into North, check myself into North Shore Hospital, like get strapped up onto the machine, get your first dose of misoprostol, and nothing. Next dose, nothing. Next dose, nothing. All the way through 48 hours, 16 doses of misoprostol, nothing. And so, yeah. So, but also, like during this time, it was like I remember like being in my room and the doors were open to the other room on the other side, and the nurse came in, and she was like, to the lady, she was like, "Okay, so you've actually tested positive, which means we're going to move you to the COVID ward." And like this was that first outbreak where like we'd never really been exposed to COVID before, and I was just like, "Man, this is so like my whole pregnancy has been marred by like COVID. Like Scott had not been able to come to a single scan or appointment. Like wasn't allowed. Like our the even the scan, they wouldn't even allow me to call him to have him on the phone, which was just so appalling and
Bizarre.
bizarre. Like that's just it's ridiculous, like to the point of like insanity. And so like my whole pregnancy had been marred by all of these COVID like precautions, and yet when it came time, like when I was at my most vulnerable and also when it was at its highest peak, like no one even shut my doors or her doors. I was like, I'm strapped in here, I can't do anything. Are you even going to like try and protect me from getting this? And so then we had all of this like drama of like, you know, of being regularly tested, and then the fact that I had been there for 48 hours and hadn't gone into labour, and so then had to go back to the obstetrician the next day to try the balloon insertion. And it was when they were doing the, like when he was trying the balloon insertion, that's when he was like realised he couldn't actually find my cervix. So when they did the LEX procedure a few years ago, they, in his words, did such a good job that there's so much scar tissue that your cervix is just basically a little like stub, and actually there's so much scar tissue there that that's why the misoprostol didn't work, because there is like there's no blood flow to your cervix. And so he was like, I can't, there's nowhere to insert the balloon, and also there's no way that you're, there's enough, there will ever be enough blood flow to the cervix for that to dilate. So so then the answer was like the only way for you was a C-section. But it was still quite interesting, because then, so I was scheduled for a C-section the next day. Well, no, I wasn't. I was scheduled to go into the hospital to have a chat about what we could do to then maybe the answer would be a C-section. It was just so bizarre. And like, I got in there and I was like, okay, so they were like, okay, come, we're prepping you for surgery now. And I was like, okay, am I having the C-section? And they're like, yeah. And I was like, okay, cool. Well, that wasn't like communicated. It was still to have a chat about what we're going to do. So, but I think it was just a bit of a time of like just rampant COVID and like can't keep up with demand. And so, yeah, so scheduled in, just in for a C-section then, which was quite scary. I felt, even though I didn't, like logically, I knew this happened and I didn't have any real like fears about it, just that waiting before you go into surgery. And I think for me, it was the crunch time where I would meet this baby and I was so worried that there was going to be something wrong with her just in that moment. Never before had I felt this, but it was this, oh my gosh, I'm finally the, like, I'm going to see her. And if something's wrong, it's going to be my fault because I've housed her for the last 9 months. It was just such a strange like thought process, but I think it was all of the, just the adrenaline of like, fine, like, you know, getting ready for surgery and just waiting outside theater and then being wheeled in and then, having to sit there, so you have to sit on the table, and they put in the spinal anesthetic and then also the epidural and as well the antibiotics as well, and then and then the process was actually then relatively quick. It was like within 10 minutes after they had tested that I couldn't feel anything, it was about 10 minutes by the time that they had her out. So it all sort of just came so fast. And it was so funny, I like, they were like, do you want to see her? And I was like, no, Scott, make sure she's okay and then bring her over to me. Like, that's how worried I was. I was just like, I want you to like make sure first and then you can bring her to me. So yeah, so that was, but like a really amazing experience, and again, why I'm really glad they didn't have any really set birth plan or hadn't created this thing in my mind about being really attached to a certain way of birthing, because at the end of the day, like, there was absolutely no option, like to the point where they're like, we're so lucky that you didn't go and you.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Didn't actually go into labor during the misoprostol because your cervix can't dilate, you would have dilated elsewhere, which probably would have led to hemorrhage. So it's actually really lucky that you never went into labor. And I think that's the thing, is when, you know, that when that is completely taken away from you, there is no other option. It is, like it's not like you can be like, oh, well, let's try. And it's like, no,
yeah,
that's not
life.
Like, whereas I think if I had these really strong thoughts about how I wanted to birth, I would have been quite resistant to that outcome. But as it was, I was like, okay, that's fine. Well, what do we do next? Like what's the outcome?
Did you feel like you knew much about C-sections, like before you went into your birth? Did you have an idea about them?
Nothing, Jordan. And I think this is again a bit of a problem with our antenatal care, and I'm so glad that you talk more about this in your antenatal class, and you're preparing for birth class, but I feel like there was only one way taught at antenatal class, and that was that you would go into labor and this would be the outcome, was having a vaginal delivery. And it's just not the reality. I mean, like a third of births in New Zealand end up in C-section, right? And I think that, a bit of information about like, okay, this is what will happen, you know, like this is where you go in the hospital, like you know you'll wait outside and you'll go in and then this will happen, you'll get like these are the if it isn't like a real true emergency, then these are the kind of things, the drugs that they'll put you in, and these are the kind of decisions that you might need to have to make, and really having that knowledge to be able to prepare for that. And the same thing with the other thing that I found that was not discussed at all was when it came to breastfeeding. What if you had low supply? And I remember bringing this up with our antenatal group in class. Was fantastic, really great, loved it. But I remember her saying only 4% of the population in the world like can't breastfeed. And I was like, yeah, but what about those just with low supply? And she was like, oh, that doesn't really exist. It's all about supply and demand. And I was like, bullshit. Categorically wrong. Like, that is, yes, supply and demand is a huge part of breastfeeding, but also having the breast tissue to be able to produce milk, having the hormonal, like, balance there enabled, that's not going to stop your prolactin from rising and all of that. Like, it's way more complicated than just supply and demand for some people. If things are going well, then yes, is, you know, that's great. But if things are not going well, then just telling someone they're not demanding it enough is like a surefire way for that mother, young mother, to start breaking down, because she is doing everything. 100%. She's pumping on the hour, every hour, plus like trying to, you know, feed as well. And it's, I just think that those are two things that if I could give any feedback about the antenatal care, that would be the two things. It's like, okay, this is in the picture perfect world what happens, and that's great, but what if it doesn't? Like, who can you see? What can you do? Rather than just being sort of left to your own devices about that.
Totally. And Claire, you just remind me, like, I don't need the reminder because I'm passionate anyway, but hearing you talk about that just like reminds me why I'm so passionate about this podcast and, you know, my birth course and all of that sort of stuff, because it's true that these things just aren't talked about, but they're actually happening every single day and are really normal. And if you're not someone who's heard about that before or had experience with that before, all you hear is, oh, you don't have enough milk because the supply and demand isn't there, and therefore it's your fault, and it's an awful feeling, and then that mum guilt starts, and it's just like a drainer on your mental health. And oh god, I could just talk about it for hours. So yeah, 100% agree with you.
Same, I am with you there. And it's just one of those things that's like, god, there is already so much that we have to think about as new mums, and it's just like, then to have someone, and I was super lucky that my blanket nurse was also really, really, and like, god, I was so lucky that I knew that this was, so I, luckily because of the work I do, I knew that about 30% of people with PCOS that have, that experience low breast milk supply. So I knew it was a risk factor, and I knew what to look out for. So the major red flags are So what happens in PCOS is that you might not actually develop the breast tissue during adolescence because your body is exposed to more testosterone and therefore maybe not as much estrogen. You might not actually develop the breast tissue that you need to make milk, right? So that's number one problem. So if you, that can be in adolescence, but it can also be during pregnancy. So one thing that I noticed during pregnancy is that I didn't really get much breast change at all. I still wore the same bra through my entire pregnancy. And so I said this to my obstetrician, who was awesome. She's she'd previously been herself through a surrogacy. So her baby was born by a surrogate. And so she started to like pump to try and stimulate her own breast milk supply. So she was great at talking me through that prenatally. But I said that to her. I was like, hey, look, Joy, I haven't actually had any change in like breast tissue, you know, like breast throughout pregnancy. And she was like, yeah, that is a red flag, Claire. Yeah, okay. Here's the number for a lactation consultant if you need it. Also, here's what you might do. Like you, we might end up prescribing you domperidone. This is what I took when I, like when my baby was born. And like, these are the things that I can do for you medically. I can't talk about herbs because I don't know anything about that, but I do know that a lot of people use homeopathic and herbal remedies as well. So go and like speak to someone who's an expert about that. But she was, yeah, she was really good. But if you didn't know that, you just think, oh, well, some people do and some people don't. And I think this is also why I didn't see, even though I was like expressing prenatally, I didn't get anything, like not a drop. And she was also like, yeah, that's also alarming. So yeah, let's look into that. But yeah, whether, and it's always like one of those things that I actually, and who knows why this is, it may have been the fact that all of that misoprostol in my system meant that, so I didn't get any let down for 10 days post-birth. And so, yeah, and then by that stage, Flossie had to be on formula as well. And so whether then the demand wasn't there, even though I was like pumping to stimulate demand, but just because then like she was getting that, there wasn't that same kind of like real cluster feeding that might stimulate it. So lots of things could have happened. But I think that for me, probably that like lack of breast tissue change was probably a big part of the fact that why I didn't get a demand. And so again, like probably like, that was probably the hardest one for me. So I wasn't super like wedded to the like birth story part, but being a nutritionist, you can't get through a nutrition degree without having it ingrained into you that breast is best and all of the evidence behind that. And so that was probably the harder one for me. But it like one thing I did do was I did go back and actually like critique a lot of that research. And and it was really good for me to see more of the later research on that. So they've done often what you hear about breast milk, and breast milk is like fantastic, but they'll often cite a big Brazilian study, which did find that there was, even when they tried to control for things like socioeconomic factors, like whether the mum, you know, was working or not working, et cetera, et cetera. They did find that babies that were breastfed had higher IQ, lower incidence of autoimmune conditions, asthma, eczema, et cetera. And so that's often what's cited. But what they don't talk about was there's also a really big study that they did in the US, which is a sibling study. And so whenever it comes to talking about like the benefits of breast milk, what's really hard is to count like the effect of socioeconomic status, which is that mums, especially in the US where they don't have a lot of maternity leave, people that are a higher socioeconomic can take longer time off work. And we know that when you have more time off work, you're more likely to be able to have the time to breastfeed. And so that is, but also when you're higher socioeconomic, your children are more likely to go to better schools, or you're more likely to have the time to spend with them going through their homework. They're more likely to see a doctor. There's so many things that also go hand in hand with that. And so I think what's really interesting is a study that they did on siblings where they looked at where one sibling was breastfed and one sibling was not breastfed. And what they found when they then looked at the difference between those siblings is they found absolutely no difference. No difference in IQ, no difference in like allergies, asthma, eczema, anything like that. And that's probably what then I found a lot easier about it sort of put my mind at ease because I had that drilled into me about like the benefits of breast milk. And so I still think that breast milk was brilliant. And so what I ended up doing was co-feeding the whole way. So I would breastfeed Flossie as much as I could. So she would just breastfeed first and then we'd top her up with formula afterwards. And even like she quickly figured out, she's a smart girl. She quickly figured out that she could get milk way quicker from the bottle, which is often cited as a reason not to bottle feed. But she did that. She's super smart. And so by 3 months, she was like, nah, I'm not breastfeeding. I know that you're going to express this and give it to me. So I'll just take the bottle feeds. And so she weaned herself. She refused to breastfeed from when she was 3 months old. And then so I ended up exclusively pumping for until like she was 7 months. And then I was like, I'm done. Like this is a huge amount of work and I'm happy to put that work in, but like I kind of drew the line in the sand and I was like, I'll do this until 6-7 months until she's starting on solids and a little bit more, getting a bit more food from that, and then I was out. But until then she was also co-fed with formula as well.
Awesome, cool. And how, so if we just backtrack a little bit to your C-section and sort of recovery there. So how did you find the initial couple of hours after your C-section and what actually happened when they did the surgery and she was born? And yeah, talk us through the sort of next couple of hours post-birth.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a blur. Like I remember, so you go out of the operating theatre and into a recovery room and they monitor you and then they do some skin on skin with the baby and then got her to try her first feed down there and then they took me up to my room and I didn't react particularly well to the morphine, so I was really itchy and really hot. And also because I'd been, because I like they'd said to me, you know, prep that you might have a C-section tomorrow, so like don't eat from this time because you're not, you know, like you're not ideally not supposed to eat. By the time I actually got into surgery, so like, you know, you're not always going to be the first person who had a C-section. I certainly wasn't. So by the time I kind of got out of there, I probably hadn't eaten for like not quite 24 hours, but probably like 18 hours. And so like my blood sugar, and I know the feeling of low blood sugar because it happened a lot when I was quite insulin resistant. It's that real feeling of like sort of shaky, jittery, can't concentrate, can't do anything until you can eat something to bring that blood glucose back up. And I just remember, I think it was that plus the morphine plus the heat. And I remember midwife came in and she was like, right, should we try baby with another feed now? And I was like, I just need something to eat. Like, can I just take a minute, like, just to recover? And she was like, yeah, okay, like, what do you want? And I was like, and she was like, do you want this, like, pale-looking mac and cheese that was on my plate? I was like, no, absolutely not. And she was like, okay, what do you want then? I was like, I don't know. Can I just choose from my snacks? Like, it was like, I just felt it was just that low level of blood sugar that I just didn't have the, like, patience to kind of, and I don't know if any of you felt like that real hangriness. So I'm like, oh my god, I just need something to eat, but it's not that, I just need something, and then like, but I can't do anything until this is like back up. So I think that and the like the morphine was just a bit like, whoa, crazy. But like once I got like some food into me, I think that was really important. Like if anyone's in the same boat, like get some food into you, take some stuff with you to like to bring that blood sugar back up. So like some, you know, sugary carby things that have a bit of protein or fat in them as well. Like I think I had some like Bliss balls, which were quite good. And then felt really good. So once they like had like a cold flannel in my head to try and like cool me down because I was feeling really, really hot, once all that kind of subsided by the evening, I was feeling pretty good. And then then I was really lucky that I could get up that night and start walking around and have a shower and just start to kind of get the body moving a bit, which was so good. Like just my recovery was really excellent, I think, because I was able to get up so quickly afterwards and actually start moving. So super lucky that I recovered really well. By the next day, like again, because of the rampant COVID, they discharged me the next morning. So it was, which is not normal for a C-section, but my obstetrician was like, hey, you're actually at more risk here. Luckily, we have had a really great nanny that was helping us with Florence, because I have worked the entire time through. We had a fantastic nanny who also was, had almost completed her training for midwifery as well. So my obstetrician was like, actually, like, because you've got that support at home, that's actually better. Like, there wasn't any place in birth care, but yet they like didn't really want me to stay in hospital because of the COVID risk. So they were like, if you can get go home and you've got that care, then do that. And so I was at home within 24 hours.
Yeah,
which was pretty great.
Yeah. I've had a C-section, and I just like remember what that postpartum period was like, and yeah, it's definitely pretty quick to get home.
Yeah, it was. But I mean, like, if I hadn't been feeling great, then they would have just kept me there. They were just like, you're feeling good, like, you're okay. Like, I was able to, you know, walk out of the hospital. Like, I wasn't in a wheelchair or anything like that. It was like, walk out. I think by the next day I was like walking up the road. I was like recovered really well. But if that's not the case for other people, then they would definitely keep you in and help you a bit more with that recovery.
Yeah. Awesome. And how did you find, I know, yeah, you said you had some like support at home, but how did you find the next week or so adjusting to life as a mum and recovering from this, you know, super major surgery? And yeah, talk us through the next week.
Yeah, the next week was pretty good. I felt pretty normal, apart from the fact that I felt like I was looking after someone else's baby. I don't know if, did you experience this? Where you're like, it's just that getting your, I don't really think that, it probably wasn't until like 3 months that I was like, it didn't feel like she was just someone else's baby that we're looking after. But I just think that's quite normal, because it's like, you just go from completely like living your own life to suddenly you've got this little baby. And so like, just, you know, your mind can't catch up that quickly to be like, no, this is, you know, well, like, you know, logically that it's your baby, but it's just that feeling of how much life has changed.
Totally.
So that was, but yeah, she was, she, again, like having our nanny was amazing, because, you know, she could really teach us like what to do and help and be that kind of encyclopedia for what's going on. And like, I remember Florence was crying, and I was like, I like, what's wrong? Like, she's fed, she's slept, she's good. And Alicia was like, she's got wind. I was like, how did you know that? She's like, you can see, like, her knees are all tucked up under her body. And I was like, again, would never have known that. So okay, cool, now that we do, what do we do about it? So it was so helpful having someone there to like teach us all of those ins and outs, especially because we hadn't been able to go to birth care. So that was really, really helpful. The breastfeeding was a challenge, and that's like, you know, when there was like no letdown and then why. So there was a lot of like trying to figure out that, a lot of mental load of trying to understand what to do and who to talk to and looking appointments and like, and then just trying to figure out how I was going to do that. A lot of pumping, of trying to feed. So I think it was just quite time consuming as well, because we're trying to like get her to feed and then also pump. So I was like feeding her and then always pumping and then also pumping on the hour every hour. So it was like, it was a lot, huge amount of work. And so anyone that's gone through that like supply demand thing, I feel for you. It is a huge amount of like of work. And then it was probably after about like the 2 week mark when like milk had finally come in, but it was still, supply was really low, that they put me on domperidone. I also just also went on to some herbs. So I went down to our local natural like herb shop and got a liquid tincture made up as well, with some herbs that have been shown to be really helpful for improving breast milk supply. And then and then it was just about like really trying to come to, I think the hardest thing for me post C-section was just that not having my independence, like not being able to drive. And you're already feeling, I think when you first have a baby, just your independence has been taken away, but because you now have a little baby to care for, plus that like extra part of a C-section, not being able to drive. So that was probably the one thing I struggled with. But apart from that, I didn't have a real huge fluctuation in hormones. So I didn't have a lot of like postpartum teariness or anything like that. So I was quite lucky. That was the only real thing that I found, was just that lack of independence.
Can definitely relate to that. And how did you find, like in terms of, I know you're about 14 months on from birth now, so how have you found your physical recovery from your C-section, and do you notice now any like impairments or any symptoms of having a C-section delivery that you can sort of notice day to day now?
No, I don't. Although I have got a lower back injury at the moment, and that's probably partially due to like weak core post. So I went through and did like a really specific returning to exercise from after a C-section, really trying to get those nerves. Because although your like abdominal muscles haven't been cut during a C-section, I thought they were, but they're not. Like it's the nerves as well. And also too, like when you have had that major surgery and you're healing, you're less likely to actually be using your core and abdomen. So that naturally will get a bit weaker. And also during pregnancy, it will naturally potentially get like weaker anyway. So that's the only thing that I've experienced, was that I have got a lower back injury. But that's not just from a C-section. This is a long-standing thing of me having poor posture and being really lazy with my core exercise and being really lazy with my stretching. So that's like part of it. But apart from that, no, nothing. I did find that I was quite tender until about 4 months. And so I specifically I was really active post C-section, with just like a lot of walking, but I didn't actually get back into doing any like real exercise until about 4 months later. And I also just didn't feel like I was really that ready or interested. So I didn't push it. And but then when I did feel good, the pain like and nerviness did disappear. I could get back into starting to learn to like do those movements again, which is why I was quite good doing a really specific return to exercise after a C-section to really focus on those, like the core and the breathing, and gradually get back to doing exercise. That's been it. But apart from that, really fortunate. Like I think within about, like a week, I was walking 30 minutes. So so my recovery was like quite quick. And also I was driving before 6 weeks. So if anyone else has had a C-section and they're feeling really good, you can actually talk to your midwife and be like, hey, I'm feeling pretty good. Like, can you check that I would be okay to drive? And my midwife was like, yep, cool, jump in the car, show me, making sure you can emergency brake, like done, cool, you're good. So that was also really nice to have like a bit of just someone to like be like, okay, so why can't I drive? Like, what's the thing that's a risk? And then like, do I actually have this? Or because everything's just a guideline, right? Like the 6 weeks is just a guideline, and some people could be longer and some people could be shorter. So that was, that was really nice. But apart from that, no other real challenges returning from a C-section.
Awesome. Very cool. And if anybody's just like, before we close the episode, if anyone's listening to this and thinking, I either think I've got PCOS symptoms, or what, like a lot of what you've sort of talked about at the start of your episode sounds like me, where does someone go for help if they think they might have PCOS or they're experiencing PCOS kind of symptoms? Give us some ideas around what to do next.
Good question. So if you think that you've got, so PCOS symptoms are really like what fits the, like it's a, so PCOS is a syndrome. So there's no like one blood test or anything like that you can go and get done to like categorically prove that you've got PCOS. It's really your doctor's best judgment. It's like irritable bowel syndrome, right? Like it's just a constellation of symptoms that we pull together to say, yeah, you've got this, you fit in this bucket. So the symptoms that we're looking for there, that your doctor will be looking for, is irregular cycles or like fertility challenges. So a regular cycle could mean that you're getting either like more than 35 day long cycles or shorter than like 23 days. More common in PCOS is to have quite longer cycles, but you might be like completely missing a period for many years, like I was as well. And this is if you're off hormonal birth control. So while you're on hormonal birth control, you won't know. You will be getting like a withdrawal bleed from the hormones. So that's one criteria. The second criteria is really symptoms of the higher androgens, which is what I was saying is like common in PCOS. So this would be either like if they test your, like do a blood test and they like test your testosterone and it's higher, that could be one factor, or you could have completely normal testosterone, but you have symptoms. So acne around your chin and jawline or on your chest or back or on your body, that could be one symptom. Hair growth, again, around your chin and jawline. Or hair loss in the like crown of your head would be another like androgen symptom. So if you've got any of those, and then the last thing would be if they do an ultrasound and they find like follicles, these are like immature baby eggs. If they find lots of those on your ovaries, that's what they call cysts, but they're not actually, they're just follicles. So if they find those on an ultrasound scan, that could be the other diagnostic criteria. But you don't have to have a scan. Like if you had irregular cycles and like hair growth around your chin and jawline, then that would like likely be enough to be diagnosed. So I would say a lot, like some GPs just don't really have the knowledge of like all the parts of PCOS. So if you think that's the case and you've just spoken to a GP and they may have run a blood test, that you're listening to this and be like, hold on, Claire said I didn't have to have high testosterone blood. I have got acne around my chin and jawline. I have got facial body hair. Then you could either like ask a doctor to refer you to a gynecologist or endocrinologist, or go and see another GP for another another like opinion would probably be the best thing to do. But otherwise, if you have those things and you suspect but you're struggling to get a diagnosis, then there's also no harm in just making some lifestyle changes and see if they improve. Like very unlikely to decrease your health and more than likely to actually improve it. So you go through and start making some changes to see if that actually helps your symptoms. Because for some people, it can take a long time to actually get a diagnosis. And it's like, well, you might as well be doing a few things at the start, like while you're waiting for that. And then, if you're interested in anything more, then we have heaps of, like, we have a podcast called PCOS Nutritionist Podcast. So you can have a listen to a few of those episodes and see if I interview lots of my patients. You can kind of hear different stories of the way that different people present PCOS. So you might like to listen to some of those. It'd be really helpful listening to someone and being like, oh, my God, yes. I am Jamie is me, like this is it, like finally someone explaining my symptoms in the way that I actually really feel them. And that can be enough for you to go, yeah, okay, well, regardless of what my doctor says, this sounds like me, and I'm going to make some of these changes and see if that helps. And often it does. It's like, as I said, PCOS is a syndrome like irritable bowel syndrome. And one thing that a lot of people find when they get diagnosed is that they're expecting this kind of miracle of like, yay, now tell me the solution. And there isn't really one a lot of the time. And so especially if your symptoms are like weight gain or acne or facial body hair, like, yes, there are some medications that can help, but a lot of the time they're not a cure-all. And so you'll still be left up kind of to your own devices to go and find a solution anyway. So there's no harm in kind of just starting to make a few changes and see if that actually helps you.
Absolutely.
So you can find us at thepcosnutritionist.com or just search in the podcast and wherever you listen to your podcast to from the PCOS Nutritionist, or find us by the same handle on Instagram, just all one word, the PCOS Nutritionist, or on TikTok as well. Where did you find us, Jordan? Was it through Instagram?
No, I actually found you through searching because I have a lot of PCOS symptoms, and I always have, but I've never had a PCOS diagnosis. I think because I've got regular cycles, and I've always had regular cycles, but I do have a lot of the other sort of symptoms that come along with PCOS. So I think I was actually searching in the podcast app for podcasts about PCOS and different types of symptoms, and yours came up, and then I found you through social media from the podcast.
Yeah, so that, and it's so common. You should listen to, I'm just trying to think, Dr. Stephanie's podcast. It's one of my patients. She had same thing, really regular cycles. What it turned out to be was just a deficiency in her luteal phase. So her, like, her periods were super regular, like every like 28, 30 days, but she just had a slightly shorter luteal phase, and that is enough to have an irregular cycle.
Yeah.
So while it wasn't long, it was just that like period between her ovulation and her her period were shorter. And that just gives you one example about like why it could be, like what might look regular can also be irregular, but your doctor would never really know how to check that luteal phase. So that's why so many people go, you know, go undiagnosed, and why, like, if you feel like you fit the pattern, like, is probably very little risk in making some lifestyle changes to give it a crack. And that's why, like, why I say to people, like, just, you know, like, you don't have to wait for a diagnosis. Yes, that's important if you want medication, or like just on a fertility journey to know whether you might be better with like letrozole instead of Clomid, you know, like those are all things that are great to have a diagnosis for. But in terms of when it comes to a lot of lifestyle changes, nah, you don't have to. You can go and give things a try if you want to.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Claire, for coming on the podcast today and sharing your story with us. I know that there'll be so many people out there that are just so stoked that we've done this episode and really get something out of everything you've shared today. So very grateful for you taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure. And thank you for everything you do. I know firsthand how much work it takes, not only to produce a podcast, but to then also promote the podcast, put on social media, keep up with all of like the show notes and the links and the everything else. And even just like thinking about like listening to who you're interviewing and thinking about what your follow-up question might be, like, it is a huge amount of work. So thank you so much for everything that you do in terms of sharing all of our stories and making it known so people can find this information, because as you've brought up in this podcast, the like a lot of the antenatal information isn't particularly comprehensive, especially if you don't fit the like Pollyanna picture of birth and post-birth. And like, if you're not a Pollyanna, then if you're like me, then like it can be really isolating and hard to get that information. So thank you so much for making it publicly available for all of us.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Kiwi Birth Tales. I hope you have enjoyed it. Claire is such a wealth of knowledge, and it was really interesting to hear about her pregnancy, birth, and postpartum experience. I'd love to hear from you if you want to give me some feedback or chat about the episode. Find me at Kiwi Birth Tales, or Jordan with a Y, JORDYN, at kiwibirthtales.com. I will be back with another birth story episode for you next week. Have a lovely weekend if you're listening to this in real time, and I will be back in your ears soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.